Thank you for tuning in to the Land and Legacy Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Adam Keith, and I've got Matt Dye here with me. We're going to be covering a lot of different stuff today. A lot of exciting stuff, a lot of really cool stuff. Kind of going back to things that I used to do a lot more of. I kind of miss those days, but then I can guarantee you that if I went back to those days, I'd say, yeah, I don't really miss it that much. But Matt, I'll let you dive in and explain.
Sounds good, Adam. And it's good to have another podcast up and going. But today we are talking about, first and foremost, public land hunting. Last week we talked about it a little bit, touched on some different techniques used when we're talking about hunting smaller properties. And some of those public ground places are small properties. So we touched on it some last week.
It was almost like we cracked open the can of worms, and now we're going to talk about it this week. It was like, hey, we told a few stories. I was like, man, I have a lot of stories on public ground hunting. Let's just go ahead and jump in next week and do one entirely about public ground hunting.
What kind of can of worms do you have? That was a very aggressive can of worms.
That
like
was
a
almost
cold
like
one?
Yeah,
like a Miller Lite like full of worms or what?
Or a Coca-Cola. Yeah. It was a Coca-Cola.
You know what
but
I
it was
pictured?
A can of worms. I don't know. Maybe they haven't come out with it. Maybe that would be the best type of fishing bait is like a can of
I think a Vienna sausages are like that potted meat, spam, but just worms.
Yeah.
That's disgusting. Okay, back to public land hunting. So, again, last week we talked a lot about it, but didn't nearly scratch the surface, even though we talked so much. And this week we're diving in and going full bore into techniques, what we've used, stories, and honestly some studies and stuff that have revolved around public land hunting and the intricacies of pressure and what that does to deer, and how as a hunter you can use that to adjust your hunting techniques to stay successful on, you know, heavily pressured areas or areas that aren't pressured, where you need to go on those public land areas to find the deer that's still moving within during daylight hours and really just increase your chances. But before we do that, we have a little special treat. Adam's actually online this week and doing some research and stumbled across something that was honestly amazing.
A guy tagged me in it. It was a guy I think that's listened to the podcast and knows how passionate we are.
What's
about,
his name?
Kyle Murray.
Kyle Murray.
He tagged me in it, and it was kind of. And he says all his caption was Adam Keith. Cut all the cedars and plant some native grasses.
Oh, he's definitely like listened to a podcast.
And so I'm like, huh, let's go and see. And it's actually a National Geographic video. So you know the quality is really
phenomenal.
Well done.
Yeah.
Really well done. And so anyway, I'll give you a brief. We're going to share this video on our page, on our Facebook page.
Today, June 10th.
So if you're listening to this and it's June 15th or whatever, you're going to have to go back a few days to see it. But I really encourage every listener out there to watch this video. It's about 8 minutes.
Yeah.
Eight something minutes long. And it is, I can't even explain how much I love this video. The production is really well done. The host is somebody, for me, he's automatically just like somebody I could sit down and listen to him talk all day long. He's an elderly gentleman, probably in his 80s or early 90s, and he basically, long story short, he bought a piece of ground, the roughest piece of ground in this area in the middle of the rolling hills of Texas.
Hill country of Texas.
Yeah. And rough place, and basically he drilled 7 wells, no water. Even after he drilled the wells, they weren't getting any water. It was limestone. And there was no springs, and it was covered in cedar trees.
Well, there were springs there, but they weren't active.
They weren't active.
They weren't running.
That's right. Yes. And so he cut all these cedars, and within 2.5 years, the first spring came bubbling out of the ground. And now there's springs all over the place.
11 springs.
There's 11 springs on this property. And basically the whole story is that he changed the habitat back to what it was before we let cedars take it over. And he uses this land for something that's educational and a learning experience for all kinds of people. And it's just a really well done. The host is incredible. The production is incredible. And I can't even, I mean, it's almost, it makes me so happy. It's good for the soul.
Oh, it is.
And so we encourage every one of you to go watch it. And maybe it encourages you to kind of reconsider what you're doing on your farm and on your property or some other property that you have access to. So
yeah, I think it's a incredible illustration of honestly what we've been talking about. And really this goes back to the podcast when we talked about the devastating floods that we had here in Missouri this spring, and you know, 11, 12 inches of rain in 24, 36 hours, and people are still cleaning up after the aftermath of that. And okay, you're talking about flooding and this guy getting water. What, how are they correlating? You know, what's the difference and how are they similar? So obviously this guy's full of cedars, chock full of cedars. And
he said there was so much brush you couldn't even walk through
there. Right.
And they dozed it out, it looked like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he dozed out the cedar trees and let the grass recolonize.
Yeah. And basically that's the essence of it all, is that rain would fall on those cedars and either get evaporated off or they'd stay and just run down the hillsides, and basically they're not, the rainwater's not infiltrating into the soil and basically filling up the aquifers underneath the ground. And Adam, when he showed that rock in the video, how like identical was the rock to what we have right here
on a lot
underneath
of our
glades, our feet?
It's just like, it's that, I forget what kind,
yeah,
of,
I think
limestone.
It's a limestone. Yeah.
It was a limestone. I forget what he called it, what type of limestone, but it was, it almost to me looks like, like one of those seashells or whatever out in the, you pick,
yeah,
up.
Yeah, very porous.
Very porous.
Yeah.
And that's what kind of limestone he had there. And
that's identical, just to the eye, anyhow, of what, you know, is here and present in
our,
southwest Missouri, northern Arkansas.
Glades,
yeah.
A lot of our rock outcroppings are, they're either, we either have flint rock in a, mm-hmm, lot of the areas that's really not, doesn't have rock outcroppings, but in the glady areas, we get these huge rocks coming,
massive,
out of the glades,
yep,
and that's what it looked like.
Yep.
And I think it's a good reminder. It was encouraging to see it because we talk about it a lot, and there's a lot of research that shows it, but people, even my dad, I hear this comment, it's like, well, there used to be water here. Grandpa used to catch fish out of this creek, and you look, and that creek hasn't had, I think I shared that story on that same podcast.
Yep, sure did.
Used to catch some fish out here, and you're like, how was that even possible? And it's because the water table is so much higher, and that's what was expressed in this video, is that the water table was almost non-existent, now it's right there. So basically,
it's,
he got the cedars out
be.
Of there. He got the cedars out. He got grass, and he filled up that underground aquifer, and whenever it's filled up, the excess water comes out in the form of a spring.
Yeah. And now he's got ponds. Story. He's got active springs. He's got creeks that are running year-round in the dead center of Texas. And I think
runs, yeah. Well, a couple of those springs, I guess, combine and turn into a creek and end up running down into the Dallas or
it
Austin?
Runs in,
Austin.
I think Austin, Texas. Yeah,
yeah, Austin, Texas.
They're able to track kind of where it goes. But I think there's a couple of just really important lessons, and this goes right back into deer management. Some things that we face as, you know, consultants and with our clients is, you know, they have the property and they think, this is what I got, so let's just do the best with it. But like the whole idea of habitat management means to change. And he saw this property and saw it as rough and saw it as, you know, a diamond in the rough. But basically, he removed the rough and prove that it is a diamond. You know, he didn't go into it saying, well, this is what I got, so this is what I got. He said,
no,
this is what I got.
I'm going to settle for the cedar trees.
Right.
He said, this is what I've got, the roughest piece of ground in the area, and I'm going to turn it
I'm going to make it what it needs to be and should be.
One line that really stuck out to me in that video is he said, we're going to work with Mother Nature,
yes,
not against Mother Nature.
Yep.
And I was just like, yes, somebody who gets it.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was a very successful business guy, but, you know, he approached it in the right manner and didn't let the current state of the habitat deter him from doing what was right. And again, you know, that goes back to, you know, when you're diving in and doing work on your property, know that, okay, it's going to take work, but it's going to take change to get to where that property needs to be. And don't be afraid of the change, because once you see the video and see the transformation of that property and the good that it had done for the wildlife, the grasses, the, you know, All the, even the amphibians who are now using the water, every single thing.
Yeah, I think there was that video of the salamander going down through the.
Yeah.
I think of the picture, I guess the screenshot that showed, I'm guessing, the neighboring property and then his property.
Yeah, the fence line. Basically, they pan from the neighbors to his. Like,
it was like straight cedars to grass country.
Grassland. Yeah.
And it was, I can't even talk. I can't even express how exciting it was to watch.
Speechless.
Yeah.
But it's incredible to see it.
Matt, come on, watch this. Watch it.
And then I'm sitting there like, oh, my gosh.
And you were like, Emily, come here and watch this.
Yeah, which is my wife. And I made her. We were laying in bed last night. I was like, okay, you need to watch this. Because one of the cool things was the guy had named his property Selah, which is from the Book of Psalms, and that means to like stop and pause and rest and to take in what's around you. And they use that in scripture to just basically pause and reflect on what had been said. But he used that as a reflection of the property and to stop and pause and look at what had happened and the change that had occurred and take in basically the beauty that, you know, God had created and the whole idea of management to restore it to what it was needed. And you know, honestly, the whole video and why we like it so much is that it really reflects everything, you know, land and legacy. And he left the video saying, you know, this is my legacy. This is what I'm leaving. And it's like, oh my gosh, my heart just like fluttered a little bit.
Yeah.
No, I'm not in love with the guy, but just the story and the example that he's leaving, because again, this is now an educational center for people to come and look at. And
he's molding minds and educating young.
Yeah.
There's several shots of like elementary age kids that are there, and
it's a learning.
They're
center.
Using that property to teach these other kids about stewardship of the land,
mm-hmm.
which is molding their minds to where they're going to go out in the future, and that's what they're going to be thinking, which is exactly what we should be thinking.
Yeah.
So this man is tip of our caps to that man, because he has just flat out just
nailed it.
And the mic drop for I forgot his name.
Old man River down in Texas
or something.
I don't know.
Something like that. But anyway, the Selah
property. Yeah. And the cool thing was that I go back, and this is just a family thing, but my granddad, who's unfortunate, he's no longer with us, but he wore that exact same hat, same camouflage pattern, basically the same hat that guy had. It's just like, dang, pulled a little bit of a heartstring for me. But seeing the property, seeing the hat, seeing Selah, which is also a funny thing that Emily, my wife, wants to name one of our kids Selah. So I was like, I want to meet this guy. This guy's awesome. Just pulling some heartstrings there. But anyhow, the video's awesome. It's going up on our Facebook page today, June 10th. And you really, really need to check it out. I encourage you to do so if you're thinking about habitat management and just the benefits of it and what a property truly can do and the transformation that it can go through. It's called 50 Years Ago, This Was a Wasteland. He changed everything. That's the name of the video. So definitely check it out. It's going to be on our Facebook page, and share it with some people, because, again, this just embodies land and legacy and just the incredible change that a property can go through. Again, 2.5 years he got water back?
Two and a half years.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It was amazing. Now let's
dive into some public land hunting.
Yeah, that's what they're all here to listen to, I think. So, public ground hunting. This is something I know there's kind of like a grass is always greener. Like, I see this a lot on Facebook and social media pages where you kill a good deer on private ground and some guy says, oh,
must be nice.
You ought to try that on public ground.
Yeah.
And then the guy that's got private ground is like, oh, I miss the days of public ground hunting. And it's just like, you miss those days, but then when you go back to them, you realize that it's not nearly as much fun as private ground. Sometimes.
Well,
but I will say I've had a lot of fun hunts. And I think for me, you know, we talk a lot about what hunting means to us. And to me, hunting is far greater than getting to say you filled a tag or put a buck on the wall. For me, a lot of my best hunts and favorite hunting stories come from trips where there was five guys and we killed one doe on public ground. And it was sitting around a fire, having a good time.
Everyone just judged you, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
And so I really don't care what
that's what hunting is to you, that what it embodies. You know?
To me, hunting is so much more. It's about the relationships, the memories,
absolutely,
and enjoying what God has given us. And
yeah.
And so I love thinking back to some of those public ground hunts. And we used to have the buck hut, which was an old, I mean, it might as well have been a pop can that we filled up with air and just swelled up to where it was like real thin, almost like that real thin tin you see on an old screen door. Like that was the casing or the shell of the buck hut. It was painted camouflage with spray paint. They bought it as the duck hut, and then we put a little line on the D and turned it into the buck hut.
Oh my.
And it had like no insulation, and we took it up to northern Missouri one time, and I, being the youngest guy of the bunch, I always hunted with older, with when I was first learning how to
Your
hunt,
brother's age.
My brother's age, who's three, 4 years older than me, and all his friends were a couple years older than him. So I hunted with the older guy. So I always got put in the worst spot. So I slept on the floor and almost froze to death, it felt like, because there was no insulation. It was super cold, northern Missouri, late October. Anyway, I just have so many great memories about public ground hunting.
About freezing your butt off.
And walking and going on trips and during the Indian summer of October, and people call it the October lull, and not seeing hardly anything. We always killed a few does, it seemed like, or a couple times we'd shoot a button buck, and it was just like, we got one. Like, can we go back and cook it up or whatever? And it was just a lot of great times.
Just memories.
Me, it was just... I just enjoy thinking back. I haven't had a great an opportunity here in the last couple of years to really go hunt those public grounds, but I still get excited and dream of the day that we're going to come out of retirement or come out of the public ground. All those buddies are now, they have private ground around and we hunt. We don't get to hunt together as much.
And families.
and it's like, one of these days, we ought to just plan another trip to where we all just pack up and go.
Just 4 days, everyone clear schedule, this is happening, let's go.
And I think about how miserable it would be, because we used to ride bikes, we used to hike in, and now we're all out of shape, and it'd just be like, this is so stupid, what are we doing?
Yeah, you'd be getting to your stand a half hour after sunrise.
Sweating, and it'd be terrible. Well, we used to do that too.
Anyhow.
We'd be late and be like, oh, whatever, it's just public ground. I want to walk to my stand anyway. But now, there were some things towards the end what we figured out that made it really successful when we started killing some good deer on public ground. A good deer, mature bucks, big bucks, whatever you want to say, what a lot of guys get out there and chase.
Mm-hmm.
We figured that out. And there were certain steps that we had to take to get there. And you know, we talk about public ground hunting all day, but at the end of it, we want to figure out how we can be successful on public ground.
Yes, and year in and year out.
And there's a couple different things. You may be going, okay, I go to this new area every single year. But for us, we're going to cover a couple topics. But let's just say your buddies call you up and they say, hey, for me, I grew up in Missouri. We're still out of Missouri. And for me growing up, it was like, hey, we're going to try let's just throw out Fountain Grove this year, which is near Chillicothe, Missouri. Or we're going to try Bunch Hollow. We're going to try, name any conservation area. It was like, okay, where is it? Oh, and they'd tell you, it's 6,000 acres near this town. Okay, sounds cool. Let's go. And
it didn't take much convincing.
No, it was just like, I love the challenge of hunting a new piece of ground. So when you get to there, I always started out hunting public ground by scouting at home.
Mm-hmm.
I would pull up now we have a great tool of Google Earth. We could get on Google Earth. We could zoom in. We could look at aerial photos, satellite images, and just kind of see what the landscape is. We can see crop fields. Some places are food plots. Some places are just straight timber. Some places may just be a lot of, like in Kansas, it may be a lot of native grasses, but just to figure out what's going on in that neighborhood. And then the great thing is you start looking on Google Earth, then you start you go make a new tab, you pull up a topographical map, and you start looking at the landscape. And we're really, at
terrain
this point,
changes.
We're really trying to locate, because I don't really like to look at crop fields as much, because when it comes to public ground, it seems like a lot of people flock to the food source. They flock to the crop field, or they flock to the food plot. And so deer don't typically get there. I mean, I think of, I used to have this rule when I was hunting, and my buddies and everybody would bug me about it, because it was like, I just want to see a bunch of deer. I come from southern Missouri. I'm not used to seeing many deer. But when I went up north and I could actually see, because there was open fields and I wasn't hunting timber, I'm like, I just want to see a lot of deer. If I go out and I see 35 deer tonight, I'm happy.
Yeah.
And there was one time on a, I forget the name of the, Reform, that's it, Reform Conservation Area near Fulton, Missouri. And I'm like, I'm going here. There was this big, huge crop field, and it was actually clover, as crazy as it sounds. It was like a 10-acre clover field. And through the middle of it, there was a ditch that wasn't planted, and it showed up on Google Earth as being an X. And I'm like, X marks the spot. So I went
there.
I'm like, I'm going to go here and see a ton of deer. And I ended up seeing like 33 deer, and I actually killed a doe. I think it was a doe. It might have been a buttonhead. Anyway, I killed a, I shot a deer, and I was the only one to kill that one, kill something that night. And it was just like, oh yeah, boys, my theory and my approach worked. It was all just plain luck, if you want to say that.
It was a 10-acre clover field.
Yeah, it's a 10-acre clover field. But a lot of times, if you're targeting mature deer, you're not gonna—they're not gonna walk out in the field like that unless they're chasing a doe during the rut when they're and they're really focused on that.
Yeah.
And but we always started finding these deer, these larger bucks, near a certain thing, and we'll dive into it a little bit later. But so first off, I want to start scouting from maps. I want to look at Google Earth, topo
maps.
And start overlaying and try to find bottlenecks. If I can find bottlenecks, so first thing I always did is I would print off a map of the area or a certain portion of the area that I'm going to hunt, and I would start putting X's. These are the areas I want to look at. And that was like, okay, scouting, the first day, I'm going to look at these areas. Key to that is I'm going to look at these areas when the wind is
right
for it.
To be able to access that
area.
So
let's say I put six areas on a map, and the wind's only good for three of those. I'm only looking at those three areas, and I'm looking at those three areas in the middle of the day. And I want to look at them when I'm less likely to bump anything or alert anything.
Correct.
And so that's what I do at home. The next thing I do at home is I call up the area manager, the biologist, property manager, wherever it is, if there even is one for that area. And I'm going to call him up and say, hey, just trying to see what's going on. I plan on being up there in a couple of weeks. Just kind of curious what's going on in the area. Are you seeing a lot of hunters? And if he tells you, I'm not seeing many hunters, just, okay, keep that in mind. If he tells you, but he's seeing hunters everywhere, you got to know, okay, hunting pressure is high. I'm going to have to kind of really watch my game, because deer are probably already on alert and most likely nocturnal, and I'll dive into how I would hunt with
those nocturnal deer. Yeah.
So, but keep in mind when you're talking to a biologist, because speaking from working as one of those guys, managing an area when I was in college and shortly after, managing a property, they're either a hunter or they're not a hunter. If they're a hunter, they're probably not going to tell you
exactly where they hunt.
Where they hunt or where the best deer are.
Or their plan B, C, and D, and E.
And you want to find out if they're a hunter, if they hunt that property.
Yep.
And so keep that in mind. Another thing, if they're not a hunter, if they're a non-hunter, then they're probably not really keyed up on where all the best sign is, where
savvy.
They're seeing deer. You know, they may have jumped a big buck on a tractor, bush hogging or whatever, and they say, oh yeah, right down here by food plot 12, that's where I saw that big buck. And you get to food plot 12 all excited, and there's no trees to hunt, or it's not set up great. It's down in a ravine.
An old weedy patch.
There's no way to really hunt it.
Yeah.
And so keep that in mind. It is nice to talk to those guys and see if they give you any tips and tricks. But I'll tell you, when I worked at a big conservation area, it's like, I don't even know, 6,000 to 8,000 acres. Whenever we kind of had this unspoken rule that when somebody asked, because we got asked that question all the time, and I'm sure everybody who ever works on there is, where's the big bucks at? Where do I hunt?
Where do I hunt?
We always just said, food plot 20. I would go up to food plot 20. Food plot 20 was a nice alfalfa field or cornfield one year, and it was just a big, beautiful field. That's just where we sent everybody. So they could just be sending you, or there was
a wild goose
I did
chase.
Have one supervisor who would always say, for some reason on that area, there was no food plot. I think it was 14. There was food plot 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way 20, but there was no food plot 14, and he always told them food plot 14.
Well, that's just
and
mean.
So it, they were looking on the map, and they're like, where's food plot 14? It was like, what? Like, it was almost like we were telling them to go to this hidden place that only
Wild
we knew
chase.
Where it was. So,
yeah.
Keep that in mind when you're scouting. And another thing
and making
to do,
those phone calls. It's almost like they're... And we'll, I was going to touch on this later on when we start talking, diving in about pressure, but there's a cultural aspect of hunting, especially public ground, that you really need to understand. You know, understand the thoughts that other people are going through and how you can use that honestly against them and to, so you have the advantage. And honestly, this is one of those cases where they might be using reverse psychology on you and you got to figure out and weave through what they're saying. Now, it still is good to call just to hear their voice and just to listen to what they're saying, because they might be a really honest person and say, no, this is, I've seen good deer come out of this place year in and year out. I'd start there. Or just kind of give you an overall direction of the habitat. You know, we're pretty much just hardwood timber, 30 years old, 40 years old. Or they might have said, hey, we just timbered this place 2 years ago over here. That's going to pique my interest. And, you know, some people might be turned away from that. Who knows? But just getting as much information as you can about a place is always a benefit.
One thing that comes to mind is when I was in high school and in the early part of college, we always put in for managed hunts on conservation areas here in Missouri. And there was a couple of them, Swan Lake and Whetstone Creek and then the August A. Bush. Those were the top three.
Mm-hmm.
And August A. Bush, every forum we ever read said it was brushy, but there was great deer. I was like, it's bow hunting. I don't really want to drive in the brush and have to go all the way to St. Louis and fight mosquitoes. Because that was one thing. They said mosquitoes as big as hummingbirds up there. I don't really want to deal with that. Swan Lake was earn a buck, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was like, I don't know. That's just my luck. There's going to be a giant step out, and I haven't shot a doe yet. And I just don't want to be tempted and have to deal with that. Whetstone Creek was mid-Missouri. It had a lot of timber, but it also had, it was kind of broken up, 50 crop, 50 timber. It was okay, Whetstone Creek it is. First year, it usually took 3 to 4 years to build up preference.
Let's real quick, some people might not know what a managed hunt is.
Okay,
break that down for
them. Missouri, managed hunt is, there's a conservation area, it's public ground, but to get on that to hunt, nobody can just drive up and hunt it.
Right.
You have to get drawn. So sometime during the summer, July, I don't even remember if it's
you
it's
put
August.
In.
You put in your name, your conservation number, and then you're put into a pile of numbers, and they pull out numbers, and you get drawn for this managed hunt. Then you buy another tag. That was the great thing is you got another buck tag just for that area.
Right.
But you had another buck tag. So if you filled your buck tags down here, you still had a buck tag to hunt on this managed hunt.
Right.
And so they may only draw 500 for a 2-week period. Several different managed hunts are set up different. You may have it for the entire season, or you may have it for 2 weeks, or you may have it for 10 days of rifle season.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just a whole bunch of different stuff. But basically, a managed hunt is public ground, but they put
it's a
your
draw
name
system,
in.
Basically.
Yeah, it's a draw system. They put your name in there, and you may get drawn and hunt with another group of hunters, but not free to everybody.
Not open from September 15th to January 15th.
Yeah. So that's what a managed hunt is. Another reason why you would call, I'll get back on that, is we got drawn. First year we put in Whetstone Creek, we thought we had won the lottery. In our minds, it was just the equivalent of winning the lottery. It was like,
I'm sure.
We're gonna fill our buck tags. Everything we'd heard about this place was fantastic. We're like, we kind of feel savvy and know what we're doing. We're going to do good up here. And we did, but there was one thing that we wish we would have known before we put in for Whetstone Creek. So, going back, this is how far back it was. We show up and we're like, man, where's all the deer? Like, then we finally ran into a guy and he's like, we got hit with blue tongue. Now I'm dialing it back because that was when everybody called it blue tongue, but it's EHD.
Yeah.
And they got hit with EHD the year before, or actually the summer of. So they're just completely, they said they lost over 60% of the deer. Because on those conservation areas, they do spotlight surveys, all kinds of surveys to see what the deer herds
are.
It was a really wet spring, so they had no crops. And it was also a year where they had a late frost in the spring. So
killed
there was
acorns.
No acorns.
Oh,
so
man.
No acorns, no crops. And low deer numbers because of EHD.
Mm-hmm.
So we were just like, we thought we'd won the lottery, but it was just like, not even close.
Yeah, not this year.
So that year, we focused entirely on clover.
Yeah.
There was few places of clover, and that's where we hunted. Mm-hmm. And
but actually, calling ahead and getting that information
would have been nice,
right?
But we were early on, and mm-hmm. we didn't call them.
Lessons learned.
But on the flip side of that is there was five of us went up there, and we had the time of our lives. And
right.
Some of my favorite stories that I share happened mm-hmm. on that. But that was one thing where I wish we'd have called ahead and known that.
Yes. Yeah.
I think we ended up killing two bucks and three does off of that.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it was work to get there. So
sure.
That's another reason why you call ahead, find out. Okay, if we'd have known that, we could have designed our plan and first day gone in and be like, okay, we're looking for clover.
Mm-hmm.
But we spent the first couple of days just looking for crops. Then we ran into the guy and we wasted a couple of days.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Keep that in mind. Call ahead. Find out what's going on. Scout from the house. So when you get up there, you have a pretty good idea where you're
already
going. You
got a plan. Exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, a managed hunt, I think sometimes they get a little bit of a, you know, a lot of people overlook them. And I'm thinking from my days back in Virginia, and I've helped run a couple managed hunts before and have put in for them. And sometimes they might seem a little bit questionable just based on the acreage. But the reason that, or the likely reason that these areas are a managed hunt versus open to the public from day one of the season to the close of the season is possibly due to the large amount of deer on the place, that they're trying to increase the number of hunters and have deer moving. And basically that's why they're doing earn a buck in some of these areas, because they want the most deer harvested off that place. Instead of just having a long drawn out season, they want to kind of hit it hard. And basically the most number of hunters that they can ethically, safely get in there to harvest deer and get out and encourage them to shoot more does. So they have the ability for an earn a buck. That's the reason why they're doing it. And so again, some of these areas are highly regulated. They might be in a suburban area, or there's a couple places back in Virginia that were ammo depots, and they were, you know, they didn't want to regulate every single day of the season. So they would open it for 3 days this month, 3 days the next month, and you drew and you had a preference of, okay, I want to pull this month. So you'd go and you hunt that month, you hunt 3 days down there. And they could regulate it a lot better, but the deer density in those areas were incredible. And they, because they're managed differently and through the state, they kind of set their own guidelines in some areas just for those specific areas. So you got 2,000 acres.
One other thing about these managed hunts mm-hmm. is they, in Missouri they are, and I'm assuming they are this in most places, but yeah. they're free to the public.
Some of them
you have to pay
for. Yeah, some, but you just pay a $10 fee.
A lot of times you have to buy another tag, but that's a whole nother tag a lot of times. That's not
mm-hmm.
in some places, Missouri, they are the same tag as your normal tag. Some places are completely different.
But when
tag,
you compare that to an out-of-state tag, if you want to go hunt a different state, you know,
or paying for a lease or
yeah.
buying land,
it's a bargain.
I love the managed hunts, and mm-hmm. I used to run some as well. And the guys that killed the good bucks were usually the guys who did things a little bit differently.
A little bit different.
And so
yep.
now we're diving into hunting. And one thing that we started to develop later on that made us successful is, and almost in life, you always, the successful people do things a little bit differently. And you have to think and how to make yourself different than everybody else.
That's where that culture aspect I was talking about earlier kind of comes in. But go ahead, I will dive
in. So for us, what we started doing was, if it was a conservation area, and I touched on this last podcast, was we would bike in. So while everybody else is walking and it takes a little bit longer to get back there, we would bike in. So we could cover a lot more ground a lot quicker. That was one advantage. Another thing we started to develop was boating. So the conservation area that I used to hunt was Drury Mincy Conservation Area, which is right along the Arkansas border, right along Bull Shoals. There was a portion of that where you could either walk, ride a bike, but it was like, I don't even know, a mile, three quarters, or three miles. It was a long ways. I'll say that. It was
enough to make you
way.
Question wanting to ride a bike.
Yes. And the bad thing was it was pretty flat mm-hmm. until you dove down towards the lake, and then it was just...
Drops off.
It was terrible. And I actually shot a doe way back there one time, and that was the only time I've ever had to quarter a deer up to get it out, because there was no possible way yeah. the other way. Because we rode bikes in
yeah.
and shot her way back next to the lake. The other side of that would have been the people that were successful were taking boats in.
Right.
And so you could boat in, beach it, beach the boat up on the shore and walk quarter mile, half a mile, whatever.
Not sweat getting to your stand like you would the other direction. Come in from a different way, and that's another way to access.
The best part about that was the lake was on the eastern half of that property. Uh-huh. So you could come in anything west or north or even south in places you had a great wind.
Yep.
The other way you were coming, if it was a west wind, the wind was at your back the whole way in. And so that's one advantage. That was a big way to make yourself different on that area is
just by boating changing in. Your access.
Another
the way
thing
you can
do is, of course, hiking. Early on, it was like, all right, I'll just walk further than everybody else. Mm-hmm. And that's one way to do it. A lot of the research, and I know you're going to share some numbers, it clearly shows that the hunter density is closer to the roads than anywhere else. And we'll touch on that in a second. But another way is canoeing. Let's say you're hunting a public ground, a small piece of ground that's got a stream running through it. Canoe or kayak your way in. Because a lot of times, especially in the afternoons as the thermals are falling, you're already set up close to the creek, which is where those thermals are most likely going to be going. So you're going to be, and you're not leaving a scent trail by canoeing in. You're not walking through a bunch of brush and leaving your scent all over the brush. You're just going to canoe in along the river. That's another way to change it up.
Yeah, yeah.
But thinking, trying to make yourself different than everybody else was and is a key to improving your hunting success on public ground.
You know, that reminds me of a story. And before we dove into the podcast, I hadn't thought about it. And then when you were talking about kayaking in and just a different approach, it hit me. I was like, holy crap, I forgot about this. So I'm going to tell a quick story. There's a public area. This is back in Virginia when I was growing up. And it flowed along the river. So it's long and narrow. And there's one section that kind of went up right along a road away from the river, a big creek that flowed into it. So you had a parking lot by the road that you'd access going south, basically, towards the river to hunt. But there's one sliver, I mean, we're talking 100 yards wide, maybe, that went north of the road. And that creek you could access was running north and south. So basically, if you were to park at the parking lot, everyone else would go south, but I was thinking, well, you know what? You want to try this a little bit different. I could put my kayak in at the parking lot and paddle upstream this creek, and then I'd have that tiny strip to hunt. And the reason for doing this was that to the north of that road was a massive crop field, and they always planted beans in there. And during the summertime, I'd drive by back and forth and see a bunch of deer in this bean field. I was like, oh, man, that would just be an awesome place. You know, wish I had that to hunt. And then I really started looking at a map, like, you know, there is a way. There's a way I could hunt that. And
well,
so,
if there's a will, there's a way.
Exactly. Man. So one day I had time, I put the kayak in the truck, drove to the parking lot, put it in. I paddled upstream, and this is just during the summer, doing that preseason scouting, and I found incredible places where deer were coming off private land, crossing that 100 acres, strip of woods right along that creek, crossing onto that, crossing the creek. The creek crossings were ridiculous. I mean, highways that deer were crossing, coming into that public ground.
Stirring up another thought that I'll touch on as soon as you're done.
So my thought was, okay, no one's doing this. Like, everyone's heading south, I'm heading north. So basically, remember the whole north and south, the way those thermals are flowing, I would be able to put my kayak in, paddle upstream, have the thermals in the morning situation hitting me in the face. If I even stayed in my kayak, hitting me in the face and pushing back down towards the south, towards the big water, and those deer would be coming out of the ag fields from the west, crossing that river on those. I mean, they were just pretty steep banks. So, I mean, you knew where they were going to cross. Crossing that creek and back onto the public land and moving across. So I would be able to access it and not stir up anything. And then again, in the evenings, if I went ahead in the evenings, I just paddle up knowing the scent was dropping from the north down the south because of the thermals. And then the deer would be moving from east to west, again, right back in the same areas. And it just was a perfect situation. And then unfortunately, I had to move away and wasn't able to hunt it, moved to a different state. But it was just, you know that movie, The Perfect Storm?
Yeah.
Like, it was summertime, and I was thinking, I'm going to kill a giant. Like, there's a good possibility that I would kill a great deer here, because the further I went up, there's basically more secluded fields, ag fields, that I didn't even know about from the road that you could see. So they were like almost a, let's say, a kill plot, that smaller bean field, ag field. Then they go out to the larger fields, closer, darker at dark. And I was just salivating there in my kayak thinking, holy cow, this is dynamite.
And how would you have hunted out of the trees in that island?
Honestly?
I think there's a great way to stay in the boat and still
That's
hunt.
Exactly what I was going to. I was already thinking, I'm building a blind, I'm tying the front of the kayak off, I'm tying the back of the kayak off to the bank, and I was able to draw from the kayak everything. And the benefit of that is the Queen's Law. And what that basically states is that moving water, riparian areas, are owned by the government, not public. And if you can navigate it with a kayak, canoe...
Not private. You said not public. Not private.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Not private.
Yes.
The water is owned by basically the government.
If it's navigable... Is that even a word?
If you can navigate it...
Yeah, how about that? We'll simplify. Excuse my Southern Ozarks... I can't say
mountain
that word.
Language.
Yeah. My language. My twang.
Yeah.
If you can navigate that water, then it's public ground. It's owned by the government.
It's basically treated by the...
The one thing is, I think in a lot of states, you can't shoot a deer that's swimming.
Correct.
So if it's walking, if it's a shallow, like Nebraska or Kansas where we hunt, where it's really shallow, it's a few inches.
That was the beautiful thing. You couldn't access it by a canoe because it was so shallow. So, and basically the deer are wading up to maybe their first little ankle joint, but my kayak, and thank gosh I was 150 pounds soaking wet then, but I was just skimming.
I thought you were still there.
Hey man, I'm trying to think. I bulked up a little bit. Anyhow, you're skimming. I could float in 6 inches of water, and I was thinking, I'm the only one who could do this. I'm the only one stupid enough to try this. But it would have worked, and I'm disappointed that I didn't or couldn't, because it was the perfect storm.
Yeah.
But that's the thing of, everyone's going south. I'm going north from this way.
You made yourself different than everyone else.
Exactly.
And deer, a lot of times deer are conditioned to the way that
everyone else
is doing it.
Yeah. That's how they avoid danger, by learning those tendencies. And if they learn those tendencies, they're going to avoid those areas. So if they're avoiding those areas, they're going to be in the areas that people aren't going to.
So now we're talking the strategy, and let's just say, since we've touched on it, deer are getting conditioned to pressure. They're getting pressured.
Right.
And what do pressured deer do?
Well, that's a great question, Adam. That's a whole nother can of worms if you want to open up another one of those over there. But there has been quite a bit of research that over the years has come out, and really, if you're one of those people, and again, you want to try things differently, this article is actually produced by Kip Adams out of QDMA.
You're getting off my topic.
I am?
What do pressured deer do?
Oh, they go away from the pressure.
And they go nocturnal.
Yes.
There's a lot of research.
I was diving in too early. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah,
that's a cue.
Hey, you're getting away from my answer and what I wanted to say.
Do you remember
last week
when I asked you a question? You didn't even know if I was addressing it to you.
Yeah, well, you just did it to me too. So now we're even.
We're even.
Well, anyway, so deer that are pressured, there's a lot of research that shows they don't leave their home range.
Correct.
And a lot of times they especially don't leave their core area. Mm-hmm. What they'll do is they stay nocturnal. They move at night. So a lot of times when you're on public ground, there's sign everywhere, but you're not seeing them. It's not that the deer just got pushed off the area, but
they're just staying down.
They're staying
down
in their secure cover, and they're moving after dark.
Right.
So how to hunt those? This is the thing that we really figured out later on, was the good deer, I don't know how to say this without just sounding like, I don't know. I'll just dive in and say, this is how we realized where all the big deer were. We were, the last 2 days we would do drives or pushes.
Mm-hmm.
We'd seen this on a lot of videos where we would put one guy upwind and let his scent run through this thicket.
Where you knew the deer were at.
We knew the deer were in there. And we would let the scent run through the thicket, and the other guys would sit around with wind in our favor and watch the deer come. They weren't busting out of there.
They weren't
like
running.
But they were easing out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we started seeing some really good bucks. And we're like, wait a second. We've walked by that little drainage how many times this week, and we have never jumped anything out of there. But when we put our scent through there and put some pressure in it, that's when they all came out.
Right.
We're like, okay, let's think about this. We would go to another area. We're like, let's just push it and see if there's anything in there. Another great deer run out of there. We're like, wow, okay, that's where they're hanging. We've been walking by. There's a good chance we've walked by that buck several times this week.
Day in and day out.
Hung there because he knows in the history of people hunting it that a lot of guys don't go in there. Like, a lot of times, those were the areas that didn't have trees you could hang in.
Right.
They were like little ditches that had scrub oaks and shingle oaks and cedars and just nasty, nasty stuff that we weren't going to walk through. That's where the bucks were hanging out, and that's where a lot of deer were hanging out.
But I think the key you said right there was you couldn't really hunt it because there wasn't really trees to hang in. And so people avoided it.
Hunting them from the ground.
People avoided them, right.
And that was
something different.
We did something different. We hunted them from the ground in the area. So deer that are nocturnal, they're moving at dark. Sometimes they may move during daylight. The only chance of you killing a nocturnal deer is the fact that he might move a little bit before dark or he's a little bit late getting back. So we started hunting close to the bedding areas.
Correct.
Close. And don't think of your traditional bedding area CRP on public ground. A lot of times those bedding areas are the thickets right next to the road, right next to the area, right next to the shop building that where the people that manage it store all their equipment. Places where people aren't walking through it constantly.
Yes.
And that was where we really started finding the deer and the good deer and the big bucks. That's where they were. And so hunting them from the ground, getting close to those areas to know that if he's going to move today before dark, I'm close enough to where he's going to walk by.
Right.
And that was the key.
Mm-hmm. You've got to remove yourself from the high pressure areas and get back to, okay, I know it's that's thick. Deer are going to be in there. That's just where I need to be. And if he's going to move, like you said, if he sticks his nose outside of that bedding area and he's within range, that's my only chance. Mm-hmm. Unless, you're hunting the rut and deer are actively moving during the day. But if you're hunting an October situation or a cold front, and then the deer have been pressured, you need to get yourself back there to those bedding areas because they're gonna want to move during daylight hours because of that cold front's getting them on their feet. And that is your best situation. It's not necessarily over a food plot. You might see some does and some younger deer. But if you are truly going after those older age class bucks, you need to learn not where they're feeding at necessarily, but you need to learn where they're bedding at and get there. Mm-hmm. And same thing in the morning. I don't want to hunt a food source in the morning. I want to get early, early, early to the place where, okay, that first 20 minutes of daylight, if I hear footsteps, it's the possibility that's a really good deer coming in because he's getting back to that bedding area before light or right after light. That's his last movement. He's getting into secure cover.
Yes, and I think that was one of our keys. And so taking that, okay, that's where we're seeing a lot of these deer is the areas where we have to hunt from the ground. That almost eliminated us. And I used to have a friend that he used to carry a stand on his back for the first couple of years we hunted together. We'd hunt public ground. He'd carry and carry and carry. And we'd be like, dude, where'd you hunt? And he's like, I didn't hunt anywhere. I just walked around. Everywhere I walked, it was like he never found the ideal spot. So it got to where he never even carried a stand. And then he started seeing a lot of good deer. And we're like,
what are you doing?
Maybe he's
what are you doing?
Then that led into we were seeing these other areas where we couldn't hang a stand. That's where all the good deer were.
Right.
So we hunted a lot from the ground
in
the areas because you either want to, it seems like you see ground blinds or you see tree stands.
Right.
And that's how a lot of people hunt. But sitting on the ground was a great, great way for us to be different. And it allowed us to hunt areas where you couldn't really put a blind or you didn't really want to put a blind. And there was no places to put a tree stand. So that's where we started hunting a lot.
You think of, okay, how did I even get here? And you think of all the success that Indians had hunting from the ground. I mean, geez.
Native Americans.
It works.
And anyway.
Excuse me. Mr. PC
another thing was It just allowed us to hunt differently.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest key was that we weren't carrying a 25-pound stand on our back and causing us to sweat more.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was a huge plus for us.
Mm-hmm.
You don't carry that stand. Therefore, you're not getting overheated as quickly, and you can walk further, and you don't have to worry about packing up a stand. And you can just... It was more mobile.
Yeah, right.
And that was a big key. So keep those things in mind, Matt. Now you have permission to go into where you were going.
You can remove the reins and not hold me back anymore. Okay, so back to the pressure deer. And I was diving in to basically a study that QDMA had shared. Kip Adams had wrote from a study done in 2002 out of Pennsylvania. So basically, they were looking to see how hunters are utilizing public hunting areas and basically the densities and how far they're going in and this and that. So what they did was in 2002, they waited till after the leaf drop so they could see and scan those woods. And they did flyovers with a airplane over. It was pretty low, so they scanned the areas. And because of Pennsylvania, I think their gun season comes in right after Thanksgiving. So during their gun season, that first part of December, they did the flyovers. And because they have to have over, I think it's 250 inches of orange, their scanning, whether it was a camera or whatever, was able to pick up where hunters were at, basically.
How densely and populated, if you will, yeah, the hunters.
Basically where they selected to hunt at. And then they correlated that with a road systems through this public ground and the terrain. So the information that I'm about to share is hopefully enlightening to the people who want to try things different or who look at public ground differently than others, because it was calculated that 87% of deer hunters hunted on 56% of the land. So that means if you're the other 13%, you have 44% of the land to hunt on. Now, Pennsylvania, this is north central Pennsylvania, I believe it was. There's some hills there, so some areas might not be that conducive to hunting. But 87% of deer hunters hunted on 56% of the land. Again, so if you're that 13%, you've got 44% of the land to run on by yourself. And so it said the percentage of area within one-third of a mile from the road. So that's that 56% of people hunted one-third of a mile from the road. So you look at this road system, and every time you're going to look at public ground, you're going to go, okay, road system, roughly 56% of people or half of the people are going to be hunting within close proximity to the road system. And to me, it's like, okay, let's change the way I'm going to approach and really think about. Let's go back to step one where we're scouting and looking at overview maps. I already know, or I can, and, you know, guess that the majority of people are hunting within this proximity to the road. So if I want to do things differently, I need to find the areas that I'm going to have to backpack in, or I'm going to have to float in, or I'm going to have to bike in to get to these areas. And to me, that's just positive news. I know I'm going to have to work a little bit harder, but I know that I'm going to distance myself away from the areas that are most densely populated in hunting. And what that means is that that's the highest pressure that deer are experiencing in those areas. So, okay, if I am avoiding those areas, I'm actually going to the areas that deer are more likely to occupy during that time because they're less pressured.
So you said a couple things in that that made me, that kind of sent a check mark in my head. I want to talk on that.
Okay.
First off, I would be a little bit upset if I hiked in early and I'm set up and I'm like, okay, it's beautiful, I'm awake, and I hear a plane come flying over. And then he's like a little bit further over. And you're just like, what is he doing?
Right.
Well, anyway, so that's the first thing. The other part of that is you touched on places that aren't conducive to hunting.
Yes.
And those, if it's not conducive to hunting, there's a good chance it doesn't get hunted much, which mm-hmm. automatically tells me there's probably a good chance some deer are hanging out in there.
Well, how many times we're in hilly country and you see deer that bed down in just the ravines where the winds just swirl. The thermals swirl. Work all the time. So the deer knows 360 out, where danger would be coming
and
from.
And even on these conservation areas, like a lot of times here in Missouri, there are some crop fields on them that they lease to a local farmer or a share crop, but a lot of times those areas aren't the prime real estate for farming. So they do have some hills. And one thing was true is if it wasn't conducive to hunting, you could almost guarantee that it had grown up and it was thick, nasty, and deer were most likely hanging out in there. You can't climb right down there in the middle of that ravine and hunt them, but you can figure out, okay, they're bedding here. Where is there water in there? If there's water in there, okay, rule that out. I'm not trying to catch them as they're going to water. Okay, where's the food at that they're going to around here? Okay, there's a food source here that's got a lot of sign on it. It seems like there's a lot of deer hanging out there. Here's the little ravine that you can't hunt. Now I'm going to get in between the two, but I'm going to hug closer to that thicket.
Closer to the ravine. Yeah.
But one really key point in hunting public ground that we figured out and just noticed and is that you have to. You absolutely have to watch where your wind goes. You can't think of all the pressure that's going on there. Deer are really keened up. They're really, they're almost like a different species, it seems like. Even with turkeys with public ground versus private ground, they act a little bit different. Public ground is, you have to watch your wind. And I kind of almost retract a little bit because I say that because I did find certain situations where close to the office or wherever they're
used to
interacting with deer a lot, or an archery range or whatever, they're used to smelling, but for the most part, you have to watch your wind because those deer, since they're so tuned up on pressure and people hunting, that as soon as they catch the wind, they're out of there.
Right.
Or they're moving around. You don't even see them. So when you really watch your wind, where it's going, how you're getting into that, that was key. And that's what's going to elevate your game to where you can continue to have success.
Right.
On public ground.
So I think, you know, again, you were talking about the areas that aren't conducive to a tree stand, where you're just not going to have the success because of the terrain or the people are avoiding because they don't want to deal with the terrain, which is actually another stat they throw into that study. So I encourage you to read it if you want to know more about it. But if you get into those areas that there is terrain differences, and here's the other one to consider is if you're hunting late season and if there's terrain, you're going to want to focus on the south-facing slopes. And if it's early season during that Indian summer or, you know, October lull where it's warmer temperatures, those deer are most likely to be on the northern side of a slope bedding because it's cooler. You know, they're not soaking in the sun all day long. So it's, you know, that's another the factor to consider if you're going into those areas where away from people where most people aren't going and where the deer are going to want to be, where they feel more safe, consider the temperature. Deer aren't going to bed in the same place every single day. They're going to move, just like they're not going to feed on the same stuff every single day. They're going to feed based on what the temperature tells them that they need to feed on. And same place with bedding. They're not going to bed the same exact place every day. So consider that if you're in those areas and distance yourself. Get away from those areas that are within a third of a mile from county road. I mean, the roads within the public ground and put yourself in a situation where you're one of those 13% people who have 44% of the land to hunt and find those areas. Use those topo maps.
Make yourself different. This has been a really, motivating podcast for me. I took a lot out of this just because it gets me back to wanting to hunt some public ground again.
Yeah.
The great part about that is now everybody's heard this podcast. They're going to be going to those unique areas, and now we've got the food plots and crop fields all to ourselves. Suckers.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, that's the culture aspect that we're talking about. Which one do you actually want to hunt? Which one are we suggesting you hunt?
I'm definitely sticking back to what we talked about. Yeah, Making myself different, boating in, hiking in, biking in, camping further back there if we have that opportunity.
But then again,
hunting
not
from the ground if I have to.
Not necessarily ruling out those areas that are close to the parking lots. If everyone is doing that, if everyone's caught on or
everyone is hiking further in and you notice that whenever you park, everybody's got a bike rack on their truck. And you look in the parking lot and there's four vehicles, all have bike racks, and you're like, everybody's biking 4 miles in or they're biking way in.
Yeah.
I may hunt right there close to the parking lot.
Yep. And don't overestimate.
Just try and it's almost this is the key to public ground for me is try to think like the deer, and then trying to think like the other hunters.
Yes.
And if the deer are doing this, if they're, and I guess it doesn't work with podcasts. I'm using my hands.
Yeah, I'm looking at you, understanding what you're saying. You're shaking your hands, Mr. Puppet.
If the deer
over
are doing
here.
This and they're way over here, and the public ground hunters are doing this and they're way over here. Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out how the deer are reacting to the other hunters and how I can take advantage
you
of that.
You have to capitalize on the fact that other people are hunting it. We're on private ground. You're the only one hunting it. You kind of control
deer,
or you know what the
deer
are doing.
Their natural state of
right.
their natural tendencies. But they do things a little bit differently on a lot of public ground.
Because of the pressure. So,
yes.
Again, you're learning what the hunters are doing, and then you're changing, adapting your tactics to know how the deer are reacting to the hunters and capitalizing, being that 13% range and going in and doing it right.
Woo! That was fun. And we're gonna have to go hunt some public ground this year. I really want to. I miss those days. I miss the camping. And you know, one time here's a public ground. We were laying around camp midday, picking seed ticks off of us, and we were kind of just laying there chilling around the campfire and just talking and laughing about the morning hunt. And we kind of hear gravel crunching. Somebody's driving up to go to the parking lot, and we look over and here's this van. And I kid you not, it was a van. I think I've showed you a picture of this. I may have to share it on it. They've taken two vans, and it was like one of them had rear-ended the other one, and they just took the axles off and threw some JB Weld up there and welded the two together with plastic. And it was like a stretch limo van that basically they had smashed two of them together is what it looked like.
That's awesome.
It was one of the funniest things I'd ever seen. And that was
their hunting rig.
You never know what you're going to see on public ground. That was funny and just another fun memory of public ground.
Yeah. Well, we honestly need to do it. We need to just devote some time scouting something, and you know, maybe that's Facebook Live stuff or you know, reviewing maps prior. We should honestly probably go through a whole process of doing it. I think that'd be cool.
We could do a Facebook Live on scouting with the maps and what we're doing. And
yeah.
I'm not going to tell them what area we're going to until we've been there.
Keep that a little bit under the wraps.
Yeah. Until we've I really wanted to do this year is pick a spot on Mark Twain National Forest or a conservation area and say, okay, look, judging on the map, this is where we're going. We're going to go scout it this summer.
Yep.
Looks good. There's some old rubs and scrapes from last year or years prior. Looks pretty good. Here's my approach. This is what I'm going to need to get in there.
Yep.
And then try and film and show that we tied it all together. And it may be only shooting a mature doe in there or Matt shooting a forked horn.
come on, man.
And
I got the itchy trigger finger.
Yeah. And so that it could be one of those and just it's a great for me. I think it's awesome and sometimes it's overlooked.
I definitely think so.
Yeah. Public ground and doing it this way. So anyway, that pretty well wraps up an hour podcast on hunting public ground. You got anything else you want to add? You look like
it. Be sure to go to Facebook page. We're getting ready to put that video up now, June 10th. Look at it. Watch it. Yeah. Share it.
June 10th, what was once a wasteland.
Yeah.
Something like that.
50 years ago.
50 years ago, what was a wasteland, this man changed it or something like that.
Everything has changed.
It's so good. And hopefully you guys learned some stuff on hunting public ground. And you can be successful using these tips and tricks. And you know what? Maybe we'll run into you on public ground someday.
That's right.
So anyway, hopefully you'll join us next week. Thank you guys for listening.
See ya. Thanks for listening to another episode of Land and Legacy's Hunting and Habitat Management Podcast. If you want to see more, check us out at landlegacy.tv or follow us on Instagram and Facebook.
Take pride in knowing that God has called us in Genesis 2:4 to work and take care of the land. So keeping that in mind, remember to do it all for the love of the land and the glory to God. Yeah.